We know actually very little about him, because the only documents that survive, really, the documentary history, the most famous that listeners would be familiar with, are the Confessions of St. Patrick. But they're not really an autobiography. What they tell us is a kind of an introduction into his soul, the spirituality, really, more than the chronological details of his life, where he was born and so on. So there are very few places actually mentioned in it. We know his father's name. Outside of that, we have a name of a town that he was born in, but even that has been kind of corrupted. So we know very little about him, that concrete sense.
Mm. And yet all the stories and myths that are around him, how much of that is story and how much of that is just fantasy?
Well, I think a lot of it is fantasy. I mean, the basic details are correct. You know, that we know that St. Patrick came to Ireland as a slave, carried as a slave from Britain. We know that he went back. When he went back to Britain again, he heard the voices calling him back to Ireland. And then he began this kind of mission to Ireland at that stage. So we know all of that. We know, too, that a cult of devotion to Patrick developed, you know, within a number of centuries after his death, and that kind of cult was written down in various documents, and it was kind of, the legends were added to it as they went along.
And the snakes?
Well, again, the snakes are part of the legend, and you know, the other kind of important thing about Patrick is that, you know, he converted Ireland without shedding a single drop of blood. All of these kind of stories. I mean, there's no way that one individual could have converted Ireland on his own. And Patrick was most likely working with a group that, in terms of canon law even, that the Pope wouldn't have sent a bishop to Ireland unless there were pre-existing communities in Ireland. And we know even from St. Patrick's own confession that he says he was one of many thousands of slaves brought into Ireland. So even if you take the numbers of slaves in Ireland when he arrived back, you could say there was a sizable Christian community here before he even came. So what Patrick is really doing is coordinating, I suppose, the Christian communities that were there before, and also kind of spreading. He says in his confessions too that he brought Christianity to people who'd never heard of Christ. So there's evidence that he was more active maybe in the north, which would have been the part of Ireland less in communication with the Roman Empire and the Christian world.
Okay. And would it have been more of a conversion? I mean, a lot of people have this idea that Christianity kind of suppressed paganism and took it over. Or would it have been more of a willing conversion?
Well, as I say, the legend says that he converted Ireland without a single conversion. I don't think that the conversion was completed as quickly as we'd like to think. And maybe even in the 7th century that Ireland hadn't been converted fully at that point. But what is clear is that in the Irish story, at least, that when Ireland was converted, they were able to bring along the pre-Christian religions. And I suppose it would be what people now in kind of missiology would talk about, you know, the process of enculturation. So they were able to almost present Christ as if he fulfilled their expectations.
Okay.
So things like the Holy Wells that we'd be familiar with, kind of pagan in their foundation, but then baptized with Christ then in the story.
Okay, so he incorporated
Absolutely. The
spirituality that was there, in a sense.
That's part of the big success, I think, of Christianity in Ireland, because the way it was grafted onto pre-Christian and much more ancient roots. And one of the things you see across the continent is that the countries that Christianity came to earliest tended to remain Catholic at the time of the Reformation. And Ireland is a very good example of that. And in a funny kind of way, the penal laws prolonged that, because they were able to present Roman Catholicism as some kind of native kind of continuum from the very beginning.
Because it sort of blended in seamlessly.
Well, it survived out of doors in places like Mass Rocks.
Yeah.
And many of those were actually located in pre-Christian sites in places like Kropatrick and pilgrimages to Loch Derg. You know, they actually thrived when the official church was suppressed by the penal laws and so on in the wake of the Reformation.
But on another issue, St. Patrick was a slave. I mean, that was why he was brought over to Ireland. And what would we learn from St. Patrick that would maybe make us more sensitive to what's happening in our society today?
Well, one of St. Patrick's documents is a letter that he wrote to a British commander, a soldier, who was effectively taking Christians into slavery. And in that, Patrick has a very strong condemnation of the treatment of slaves. And in a funny kind of a way, commentators say that even in Patrick's condemnation of slavery, he kind of prefigures some of the arguments that were made in the 19th century, the late 18th and 19th century for the abolition of slavery. Now, the big thing about slavery, of course, is that you actually, the master owns the individual.
Mm.
It's not that they own their labor, but they actually own them lock, stock and barrel. They're a chattel. They can do with them what they like. And they become what one writer, Orlando Patterson, says slavery is a form of social death, that the person dies.
Mm.
Now, the whole triumph of the abolition campaign was that the campaign succeeded on identifying the essential humanity of the slave. And listeners will be familiar with, you know, the picture of the slave in chains that Wedgwood produced, and the motto underneath, "Am I not a brother like you?" And that's precisely the point, that the move from the non-person, the property, the chattel, into an individual like us, somebody that we can empathize with us. And our own Roger Casement, he was quite cynical about the abolition of the slave trade. And, I mean, the way he put it was that slavery hadn't been abolished, but it had simply been deregulated.
Mm.
And ironically, that slaves were protected as slaves under the slave laws.
But right, because at least you were owned by someone and they were accountable. Yeah. And has it got worse then, in a sense, since the abolition?
Well, it depends on whose statistics that you look at. I mean, some of the statistics that are offered now say that there are about 12 million slaves in the world today in 2008. Now, at the height of the slave trade, about 100,000 slaves crossed the Atlantic every year. So maybe 10 million slaves crossed altogether during the slave trade, 10 million. And we're talking now about 12 million people in the world. And I suppose the manifestation that we'd be most familiar with is human trafficking.
Mm.
And even on that, the kind of statistics that the U.S. State Department say that 800,000 people are trafficked every year, 800,000.
Wow.
And 500,000 of those, they reckon, are trafficked into Western Europe. And the bulk of those are obviously women and children, and a large number of them are exploited sexually. That was one of Patrick's criticisms of Caratacus taking away the slaves, because they were taking away these Christians to be sold into prostitution, effectively.